Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I ended the last show by discussing an audit of the banks and a tax on derivatives. Even if the mega banks or some of them are already bankrupt, we might not hear about it without an independent congressional audit. The over-the-counter derivative scheme masking their insolvency is largely hidden from public view. One way to bring it into the light would be for Congress to impose a tax on all financial transactions. This form of tax is called a Tobin tax, after economist James Tobin, who received a Bank of Sweden prize in economics in 1981. Even a very modest tax of 0.1% would bring derivatives trades out into the open, allowing them to be traced and regulated. And because derivative trading is in such high volume, the tax would have the further benefit of generating significant revenue for the government. Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington points out that financial transactions taxes have been successfully implemented in the past and have often raised substantial revenue. Until recently, every industrialized nation imposed taxes on trades in its stock markets, and several still do. Until 1966, the United States placed a tax of 0.1% on shares of stock when they were first issued, and a tax of 0.04% when they were traded. a tax of 0.003% is still imposed on stock trades to finance SEC operations. Baker notes that the vast majority of stock trades and other financial transactions are done by short-term traders who hold assets for less than a year and often for less than a day. Unlike long-term stock investment, these trades are essentially a form of gambling. He writes, quote, "When an investor buys a share of stock in a company that she has researched and holds it for 10 years, that is not gambling. But when a day trader buys a stock at 2 p.m. and sells it at 3 p.m., this is gambling. Similarly, the huge bets made by hedge funds on small changes in interest rates or currency prices is another form of gambling." End quote. When poor and middle-income people gamble, they usually engage in one of the heavily taxed forms, such as buying lottery tickets or going to a racetrack. But wealthier people who gamble in the stock market escape taxation. Baker argues that a tax on derivative trades would only be fair, equalizing the rules of the game. Quote, "Insofar as possible, taxes should be shifted away from productive activity and onto unproductive activity. In recognition of this basic economic principle, the government already taxes most forms of gambling quite heavily. For example, gambling on horse races is taxed at between 3 and 10%. Casino gambling in the states where it is allowed is taxed at rates between 6.25 and 20%. State lotteries are taxed at a rate of close to 40%. Stock market trading is the only form of gambling that largely escapes taxation. This is doubly inefficient. The government has no reason to favor one form of gambling over others, and it is far better economically to tax unproductive activities than productive ones. From an economic standpoint, the nation is certainly no better off if people do their gambling on Wall Street rather than in Atlantic City or Las Vegas. In fact, there are reasons to believe that the nation is better off if people gamble in Las Vegas, since gambling on Wall Street can destabilize the functioning of financial markets. Many economists have argued that speculators cause the price of stocks and other assets to diverge from their fundamental values." End quote. A tax on short-term trades would impose a significant tax on speculators while leaving long-term investors largely unaffected. According to Baker, a tax of as little as 0.25% imposed on each purchase or sale of a share of stock, along with the comparable tax on the transfer of other assets such as bonds, options, futures, and foreign currency, could easily have netted the Treasury $120 billion in 2000. By December 2007, according to the Bank for International Settlements, derivatives tallied in at $681 trillion. A tax of 0.25% of that sum would have added $1.7 trillion to the government coffers. A derivatives tax might do more than just raise money for the government. It could actually kill the derivatives business, since even a very small tax leveraged over many trades would make them unprofitable. Killing the derivatives business, in turn, could propel some very big banks into bankruptcy, but the flea's loss could be the dog's gain. The handful of banks in which 97% of U.S. bank-held derivatives are concentrated are the same banks that are engaging in vulture capitalism, bear raids through collusive short selling, and a massive derivative scheme that allows them to manipulate markets and destroy businesses. A tax on derivatives could expose these corrupt practices and bring both the schemes and the culpable banks under public control. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's move on to the next set of ideas, the quick fix, a government that pays for itself. And again, back to the Wizard of Oz in the chapter on the winged monkeys. The strange creatures set the travelers down carefully before the gate of the city and then flew swiftly away. "That was a good ride," said the little girl. "Yes, and a quick way out of our troubles," replied the lion. A tax on derivatives could be a useful tool, but the ideal government would be one that was self-sustaining without imposing either taxes or amounting debt on its citizens. As Richard Russell observed, if the U.S. issued its own money, that money could cover all its expenses and taxes would not be necessary. If the Federal Reserve were made what most people think it now is, an arm of the federal government, and if the federal government had been vested with the authority to create the national money supply in all its forms, the government would have access to enough money to spend on anything it needed or wanted. The obvious problem with that quick fix is that it would eventually produce serious inflation unless the money were siphoned back out of the economy in some way. The questions considered now will be how much new money could the government put into the economy annually without creating dangerous price inflation? Would the sum be sufficient to replace income taxes? How about other taxes? Would it be enough to fund new and needed projects not currently in the federal budget, such as sustainable energy development, restoration of infrastructure, and affordable public housing? Well, we'll look at this. How about no more income taxes? Assume that the Federal Reserve had used its new greenback issuing power to buy back the entire outstanding federal debt and that it had acquired enough bank branches, either by purchase or by FDIC takeover in receivership, to service the depository and credit needs of the public. What impact would those alterations have on the federal income tax burden? To explore the possibilities, we'll use U.S. data from fiscal year 2005, that is ending in September of 2005, the last year for which M3 was reported. The total individual income taxes in 2005 came to $927 billion. Taxpayers paid $352 billion in interest that year on the federal debt. If the debt had been paid off, this interest could have been cut from the national budget, reducing the tax burden by that sum. Total assets in the form of bank credit for all U.S. commercial banks in fiscal year 2005 were reported at $7.4 trillion. Assuming an average collective interest rate on bank loans of about 5%, approximately $370 billion were thus paid in interest that year. If roughly half this sum had gone to a newly formed national banking system for loans made at the federal funds rate to private lending institutions, interest on credit card debt, loans to small businesses, and so forth, the government could have earned around $185 billion in interest in the fiscal year 2005. Adding these two adjustments together, the public tax bill might have been reduced by around $537 billion in 2005. Deducting this sum from $927 billion leaves $390 billion. This is the approximate sum the government would have had to generate in new greenbacks to eliminate federal income taxes altogether in fiscal year 2005. What would adding $390 billion do to the money supply and consumer prices? In 2005, M3 was $9.7 trillion. Adding $390 billion would have expanded M3 by only 4%. Milton Friedman's modest target rate, and far less than the money supply actually grew in 2006. That was the year the Fed quit reporting M3, but the figures have been calculated privately by other sources. Economist John Williams has a website called Shadow Government Statistics, which exposes and analyzes the flaws in current U.S. government data and reporting. He states that in July 2006, the annual growth in M3 was over 9%. We've seen that this growth must have come from fiat money created as loans by the Federal Reserve and the banks. Thus, if new debt-free greenbacks had been issued by the Treasury instead, inflation of the money supply could actually have been reduced from 9% to a modest 4% without cutting government programs or adding a burgeoning federal debt. So we can look at a horn of plenty, avoiding inflation by increasing supply and demand together. New greenbacks in the sum of $390 billion would have been enough to eliminate income taxes, but according to Keynes, the government could have issued quite a bit more than that without dangerously inflating prices. He said that if the funds were used to put the unemployed to work, making new goods and services, new currency could safely be added up to the point of full employment without creating price inflation. The gross domestic product, GDP, would just increase by the value of the newly made goods and services, keeping supply and demand in balance. How much is the U.S. workforce underemployed today? In the first half of 2006, the official unemployment rate was 4.6%. But critics say the figure was low because it included only people applying for unemployment benefits. It did not include those who were no longer eligible for benefits, those who had given up, or those whose skills and education were underutilized, people working part-time who wanted to work full-time, engineers working as taxi drivers, computer programmers working as store clerks, and so forth. According to Williams, Shadow Government Statistics website, the real U.S. unemployment figure in early 2006 was a full 12%. The reported GDP in 2005 was $12.5 trillion. If Williams' unemployment figure is correct, $12.5 trillion represented only 88% of the country's productive capacity in 2005. Extrapolating upwards, 100% productive capacity would have generated a GDP of $14.2 trillion, or $1.7 trillion more than was actually produced in 2005. That means another $1.7 trillion in new greenbacks could have been spent into the economy for productive purposes in 2005 without creating significant price inflation. What could you do with $1.7 trillion? That's $1,700 billion. According to a United Nations report in 1995, a mere $80 billion added to existing resources would have been enough to cut world poverty and hunger in half, achieving universal primary education and gender equality, reduce under-5 mortality by two-thirds, and maternal mortality by three-quarters, reverse the spread of HIV/AIDS and half the proportion of people without access to safe water worldwide. For comparative purposes, here are some typical U.S. government outlays. $76 billion went for education in 2005. $26.6 billion went for natural resources and the environment, and $69.1 billion went for veterans' benefits. Under this projected scenario, these and other necessary services could have been expanded and many others could have been added, while at the same time eliminating federal income taxes and the federal debt without creating dangerous inflation. And I'll return in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, what about a non-inflationary national dividend or basic income guarantee. Other theorists have gone further than Keynes. Richard Cook is a retired federal analyst who served at the U.S. Treasury Department and now writes and lectures on monetary policy. Using 2006 figures, he noted that the U.S. gross domestic product came to $12.98 trillion, while the total national income came to only $10.23 trillion, and at least 10% of that income was reinvested rather than spent on goods and services. Total available purchasing power was thus only about $9.21 trillion, or $3.77 trillion less than the collective price of goods and services sold. Where did the consumers get the extra $3.77 trillion? They had to borrow it, and they borrowed it from banks that created it with accounting entries. If the government were to replace this bank-created money with debt-free greenbacks, the total money supply would remain unchanged. That means a whopping $3.77 trillion in new government-issued money might be fed into the economy without increasing the inflation rate. This opens another rainbow-hued dimension of possibilities. What could the government do with $3.77 trillion? In a 1924 book called Social Credit, C.H. Douglas suggested that government-issued money could be used to pay a guaranteed basic income for all. Richard Cook proposes a national dividend of $10,000 per adult and $5,000 per dependent child annually. The U.S. population was about 303 million people in 2007, of whom 27.4% were under age 20. That works out to $2,200 billion for adults and $415 billion for children, or $2,615 billion, that's $2.615 trillion, to provide a basic security blanket for everyone. If $3.77 trillion in greenback dollars were issued to fill the gap between GDP and purchasing power, and $2.615 trillion of this money were distributed among the population, the government would still have $1.155 trillion left over, ample to satisfy its budgetary needs. The concept of a national dividend is interesting, but, of course, controversial. On the one hand, the result could be a class of drones willing to live at subsistence level to avoid work. On the other hand, a national dividend would be a boon to artists and inventors willing to live frugally in order to explore their art. During the culturally rich Renaissance, art, literature, and science were furthered by a leisure class favored by inheritance. A national dividend would give that birthright to all. Meanwhile, most people desire a lifestyle beyond mere subsistence and would no doubt be willing to pursue productive employment to acquire it. Another proposal favored by a number of economists is a basic income guarantee, a sum of money sufficient to assure that no citizen's income falls below some minimum level. The difference, says Cook, is that a national dividend would be tied to national production and consumption data and might vary from year to year. A guaranteed minimum income would be a fixed figure, paid without complicated paperwork or qualifying tests. However Congress decides to spend the money, the important point here is that, using the 2006 figures, the government might be able to issue and spend as much as $3.77 trillion into the economy without creating hyperinflation. Perhaps not all at once, but at least over time. The money would merely make up for the shortfall between GDP and purchasing power, gradually replacing the debt money created as loans by private banks. If the unemployed and underemployed people acquired incomes they could live on, they would no longer need to take out loans at exorbitant interest rates to pay their bills. homeowners with money to spare would pay down their mortgages, and fewer subprime borrowers would be induced to acquire new debt, since aggressive lending tactics would have disappeared along with the fractional reserve banking system that made them profitable. Meanwhile, a tax imposed on derivatives could put a brake on the exploding derivatives bubble and its accompanying debt burden. And if the big derivative banks were put into FDIC receivership, the derivative Ponzi scheme might be carefully unwound, liquidating large amounts of virtual debt with it. As these sources of debt money shrank, there would be increasing room for expanding the money supply by funding public projects with newly issued greenbacks. Among other possible uses for this $3.77 trillion in newfound capital might be to salvage the distressed housing market. Estimates as of 2007 were that the subprime debacle and ARM resets could throw mortgages valued at $1 trillion into default, either because the borrowers could not afford the payments or because they would have no incentive to keep paying on the homes worth less than was owed on them. One proposed solution was to slow foreclosures by imposing a freeze on interest rates, keeping ARM rates from going higher. But that would violate the sanctity of contracts, forcing unwary buyers of mortgage-backed securities to bear the loss on investments that had been stamped AAA by bank-funded rating agencies. By rights, the banks devising these dubious investment vehicles to get loans off their books should be held liable. But the banks are already in serious financial trouble and would be hard-pressed to find an extra $1 trillion to compensate the victims. If the securities holders sue the banks for restitution, even the hardiest banks could go bankrupt. Where then can a deep pocket be found to set things right? Today, the world's central banks are extending billions of dollars in computer-generated money to bail out their cronies, but these loans are just buying time, without restoring homeowners to their homes or preventing abandoned neighborhoods from deteriorating. So who is left to save the day? If Congress were to issue the $3.77 trillion to fill the gap between purchasing power and GDP, it could use one quarter of this money to buy defaulting mortgages from MBS holders, and it would still have plenty left over to meet its budget without levying income taxes. Adding a potential $1.7 trillion or more from a tax on derivatives would provide ample money for other programs as well. After reimbursing the defrauded MBS holders, Congress could dispose of the distressed properties however it deemed fair. To avoid either giving defaulting homeowners a windfall or turning them out into the streets, one possibility might be to rent the homes to their current occupants at affordable prices, at least until some other equitable solution could be found. The rents could then be cycled back to the government, helping to drain excess liquidity from the money supply. And this dovetails into another way of viewing the inflation problem. The government could create all the new money it needed or wanted if it had ways to drain the economic bathtub by recycling the funds back to itself. Instead of issuing new money the next time around, it could just spend these recycled funds, keeping the money supply stable. The usual way to draw money back to the Treasury is through taxes. Indeed, it has been argued that governments must tax in order to siphon excess money out of the system. But the Pennsylvania experience showed that inflation would not result if the government lent new money into the economy, since the money would be drawn back out when the debt was repaid. And new money spent into the economy could be recycled back to the government in the form of interest due on loans and fees for other public services. And we will continue this analysis in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.